You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 14th of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's show.
It's hard to sort of say who's right or wrong. I mean, this is a very complicated situation here. But at the end of the day, there are still people dying. And the long-term effect of this is going to have a humanitarian one.
From the ongoing conflict in Gaza to an American's bid to create the Kingdom of North Sudan, we'll review the day's top news stories with Samira Shackle and Martin Plout. Then I talk art films with curator Omar Khalif from the Whitechapel Gallery in London.
I think these works are all classified as artist films because they actually benefit from the context of the art institution and that kind of liberating space whereby they're not read literally, they are read as pieces that have a kind of aesthetic or conceptual language to them.
We'll also be catching up with our correspondent in Belgrade, and Kimberly Bradley will review the latest and the greatest on the Greek art scene. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, starting right now. Well, plenty to come then in the next hour here on Midori House. But before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news.
Monocle 24 News. Salvage teams say the wrecked Italian cruise ship Costa Concordia has been successfully raised from the undersea platform it's been resting on for the past year. The wreck, the target of one of the biggest maritime salvage operations in history, is now floating about 1 metre off the platform. In all, the refloating operation is expected to take 6 or 7 days. The ship will then be towed to its home port of Genoa, where it'll be scrapped. The ship's captain, Francesco Cettino, is on trial accused of manslaughter and causing a shipwreck as he sailed too close to shore. He's fighting the charges. Ukrainian military officials say a military transport aircraft has been shot down in the east amid fighting with separatist rebels. They say the AN-26 plane was hit at an altitude of 6,500 metres. The plane was targeted with a more powerful missile than a shoulder-carried missile, probably fired, according to correspondents, from Russia. The crew survived. Russia has made no comment. Palestinian militants have resumed rocket attacks on Tel Aviv after a 24-hour lull in strikes on the Israeli commercial capital. Israel, in turn, has kept up its air and naval bombardments of the Gaza Strip, despite growing pressure for a ceasefire. Iraq's parliament has failed to break a political deadlock that's holding up the formation of a new government. After a brief session, parliamentary officials put off until Tuesday efforts to reach agreement between Shiite, Sunni and Kurdish politicians on the posts of Prime Minister, President and Parliamentary Speaker. Nigeria's President Goodluck Jonathan has promised that more than 200 Nigerian schoolgirls kidnapped by Islamist militants would soon return home. He made the pledge at a meeting with teenage Pakistani activist Malala Yousafzai. Malala, who became a global celebrity after surviving being shot in the head by the Taliban for campaigning for girls' education, was visiting Nigeria to support an international campaign for the release of the teenage students abducted in mid-April by the Islamist insurgent group Boko Haram. She spoke to reporters after a 45-minute meeting with Mr. Jonathan at the presidential villa in Abuja.
My birthday wish this year is to speak up for the Nigerian girls and to see my sisters who are under the abduction of Boko Haram, to see them returning back to their homes. And for that reason, today, I spoke to the president of Nigeria. That these are the problems that my sisters are facing, who escaped from the imprisonment of Boko Haram. And the president fortunately promised me that he will do something for these girls. And he promised me that the girls will be returned as soon as possible.
The chief executive of Qatar Airways, Akbar Al-Bakir, says he has rejected the first three new A380 Super Jumbos supplied by Airbus. Mr. Al-Bakir added that the airline was not yet ready to finalise an order for 50 Boeing 777X aircraft, the US plane maker's new version of its 777 long-haul jet. Delivery of Qatar Airways' first three A380s was hit by delays due to unresolved cabin issues, forcing Qatar to withdraw the jet from the Farnborough Airshow, which is taking place in the UK this week. The Church of England's governing body has voted in favour of allowing women bishops, overturning centuries of tradition in a church that has been deeply divided over the issue. After almost 5 hours of debate, the General Synod, the governing body of the Church of England, approved the proposal to allow women to take up senior roles in the church. Results were read out by the Archbishop of York, John Sentamu.
They voted in the House of Laity in favour 152, against 45, abstention 5. The motion has been carried in all three houses.
And that's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. I'll be right back after this.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06, which means it's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Martin Plaut, Senior Research Fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and the London-based journalist Samira Shackle. Welcome both to the programme. We're going to start the show with the ongoing situation in Gaza. Officials in the Palestinian territories say that 172 people have now been killed since last Tuesday when Israel's operation against the Strip began. Martin, it's one of those situations where nobody is going to come out of this very well. And there seems we're going to talk a little bit later about the kind of attempts to kind of negotiate some kind of peace discussion, some peace here. But just as a snapshot of what's going on, do you feel that there is a kind of an opening yet for a diplomatic role?
I don't think so. I mean, to put it bluntly, I don't think enough people have died. You know, this is one of those terrible situations where the pain has to be ratcheted up to a certain level. And then finally, you know, both sides feel they've sacrificed enough, they've made their points, and we get back to square one, which is a totally unsatisfactory position. I mean, you know, the situation at the moment is completely unresolvable. In the past, you used to resolve issues like this because one side or other would win. You'd have a final victory, and then you'd push on, and that would be it. The issue would be resolved for good or ill. But with the current situation where you have vast international, shall we say, monitoring of the situation, everyone says you can't do this, you can do this, you can't do this, and so forth, there's a lot of pressure on people, there's never a final outcome. So this is just one stage in a tragic series of stages. How it'll end, one can't tell.
Samira, I wanted to ask you, I guess one of the things that normally forces people to the negotiation table is, you know, that when they feel their kind of their reputations on the international stage are being damaged a little bit. Here, nobody really cares, it seems, that much about their international standing. And, you know, I don't think the Israelis care too much what people think in London, and the Palestinians, I'm not sure they're too worried about what's going on in DC. They're so kind of interlocked in their kind of anger with each other. Do you think that, you know, this idea of outside forces coming to bear on them and kind of trying to, you know, in basic senses, you know, kind of bring them together in some, do you think that's just impossible?
Yeah, I think, I don't know if it's impossible. I think there's certainly been some anxiety in the last few years in Israel, certainly about international isolation. But I think, as you say, that in this sort of instance, it's such a case of sort of two horns locking that I don't know how relevant that is. And I mean, the most depressing thing about it, I think, is that it's just a replay of the same sort of conflict we've seen coming up again and again at sort of short intervals for the last 60 years. And it's very difficult to see what would break that deadlock. And I think the whole question of international isolation and so on becomes less relevant when you have two sides which so thoroughly believe their own version of the story. And so, you know, international observers might say, for instance, that Israel's sort of reacted overly harshly as in past bombardments of Gaza, yet the Israeli establishment has a very, very strong sort of argument that it was provoked and that Hamas is using civilians as human shields and so on. So I think it's because it's so well walked, these paths, both sides have their arguments so sort of set down, and it becomes very difficult to then see a way out of it.
Martin, what do you make of the coverage that we're getting? Yesterday when I was walking through central London near the BBC, there was, you know, dozens of cars driven by seemingly reasonably wealthy Arab people with flying the Palestinian flags. And they were really angry. They were circling the BBC and they were denouncing the BBC for their coverage. Do you think that the you know, and on the Israeli side as well, we're seeing a belief that they're getting the kind of they're always being blamed for everything, where there's not enough criticism of Hamas. What do you make of the coverage? Do you think it's just one of those very impossible situations to cover, where you do bring along both sides, feeling that you're telling a good story?
Well, I mean, both sides certainly criticize. I know when I worked for the BBC, for nearly 30 years, you'd always get tremendous attacks from both sides on what you did. I mean, the Palestinians would quite rightly say, why don't you treat this as an atrocity? If the BBC did, then the Israelis would, or the Jewish groups in this country would then come out and say, you're not being fair, you're being biased. So you could never win. It was a hopeless situation. But I mean, the sort of protests that you get from, as you say, the one you saw outside the BBC, are utterly pointless. I mean, these are just people making themselves feel better. Why are these people not going and seeing their members of parliament? Why are Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims, shall we say, in America, not mobilizing in the way that the Jewish lobby does in America? These are democracies. They can be shifted. But they'd rather wave a flag and churn around and be angry than actually engage seriously with the democratic process. They could change American policy. They can't be bothered.
Samira, your reading of the situation. I've been watching the kind of Al Jazeera coverage, which treats it almost like some hideous football match. They have a kind of scorecard up. The number of people killed in Gaza versus the number of Israeli kills, and you always see the zero there. Mm-hmm. Again, do you think that much of the coverage we're seeing in the end is incendiary?
I think it's difficult not to be, perhaps, but I think that something like that Al Jazeera coverage is sort of quite explicitly targeted at correcting a perceived balance. Whether or not that imbalance exists is a matter for debate, certainly. But I mean, I certainly have felt seeing some of the coverage that there's as you say, it's sort of incendiary on both sides. But I think that the so much of the coverage in the early stages, particularly, that there's this sort of disparity that when the Palestinians aren't named. I think one of the things Al Jazeera did was to sort of name the dead in Gaza, because there's a thing sort of when people die on the Israeli side, it's a big event, as each death should be, really. But it's this huge disparity in life. So I think that sort of coverage, it is quite grotesque, I think, to portray it as a scorecard, because it sort of feeds into this whole thing that it's a sort of failure of two sides to see each other as human. That's the ultimate tragedy, isn't it? And it sort of feeds into that to sort of make that explicit comparison in life. But I think it's a really, really difficult question how you cover it appropriately and sensitively.
Now, we were talking about the attempts here to get some kind of negotiated peace. And one of the people who has kind of slightly put their hand up and said that he would be willing to help is John Kerry. But John Kerry is certainly busy. He's just agreed to stay for an additional day in Vienna, where he's negotiating with Iran over the nuclear issue. He's been dealing with the outcome of the elections in Afghanistan and the attempts there to kind of find some resolution. John Kerry, Martin, what do you make of him as this shuttle diplomacist?
Well, he's obviously trying incredibly hard. He's a man of great capacity and courage. I mean, as he showed in the Vietnam War, he is a man of real substance. But, it reminds me a bit of when I was a kid. I used to go out fighting fires on Table Mountain in Cape Town. And, you just flap around and spread sparks. And, I'm just not convinced that there's much that can be done at this stage. As I say, the difficulty is, in the beginning, is that it has not reached a situation where people want to have peace. When you want to have peace, then a mediator from outside can play an extraordinarily helpful role in bringing people together. But when people want to fight, there is almost nothing that you can do to enforce your will. I mean, the only thing that would do it would be if the Americans were prepared to reduce their huge subsidies to the Israelis. And they're not prepared to do that for the reason that I outlined earlier, that the Arab lobby in the United States doesn't mobilize against it. So I don't think there's an opening for him. He may wish to see it, but apparently he's been there something like 11 times since he became the Secretary of State. I mean, do you see any movement?
Samira, yeah, obviously the personal relationship between President Obama and Benjamin Netanyahu is well known to be pretty disastrous. And much of this is done on personal relationships, and not just, you know, in Israel, but, you know, in Afghanistan, you know, there's a kind of, it's clear that, you know, they're not very happy with the last days of Karzai, and now they're kind of faced with a situation where they don't know who to back as the winner in the elections there. Perhaps things are going slightly better in the sense that Iran and them the US are at least talking. But again, it's kind of bogged down. Do you think that the US still has, you know, the nimbleness and, more importantly, the credibility in all these different places to send in Kerry, for example, to kind of negotiate like this in different places?
Well, I think that, I mean, you can't really expect results just from the sheer number of trips, as, for instance, Kerry's trips to the Middle East have shown. It's a sort of difficult time, I think, in the Middle East in general for the US, because I think the Arab Spring revolutions, the end of various wars and sort of troop pullouts and so on, is it's a period of declining influence and also just shifting power balances in the region. And I think the US, Kerry, Obama, the whole White House establishment doesn't quite know how to deal with that. I think, for instance, one of the reasons perhaps that Kerry would be less able to mediate peace in Gaza, in Israel now, than Hillary Clinton was in 2012, is because in 2012 she could sort of count on the support of the Egyptian government, and now Kerry can't necessarily rely on that support. And you sort of need regional partnerships as well when you're sort of trying to exert influence on something overseas. So, yeah, I think that, you know, all the talk about Kerry sort of racking up air miles is sort of quite arbitrary, really, because I think that you sort of have to judge it on results, and you can make a case either way. There's been no peace in the Middle East, certainly, but a peace process was restarted, although it was abortive. And on the other hand, there's been huge developments, as you said, in Iran, like there has been an agreement. However, that's floundering now.
Martin, it's funny when you look at the situation where, you know, if it hadn't been for the Arab Spring, at least they had kind of like partners that they knew what they stood for in the past. You know, now, you know, they're Egypt is less reliable. You know, certainly you can't go to, you know, rely on anything, even backwater diplomacy with the Syrians or with the Iraqis. For America, these past few years have kind of just left it kind of a little bit unsure about how to play its hand, don't you think?
No, I think the Americans are now quite clear on which the way they should play in their hand. And I think that they've decided that the Arab Spring was a mistake and that al-Sisi is the man to back. He's Nasser Mark II. You know, and why not go back? You're just going back to the old generals.
Well, less than cheerful note, we'll leave it there for a moment. Martin Plout and Samira Shackle joining me here for Midori House. We're going to be back just after this.
Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your art kicks. Just recently, we've welcomed Tracy Emin, Damien Hirst and Anish Kapoor to the show. Culture on Monocle 24 is where you get your musical licks. Just the other day, Gregory Porter, Casey Musgraves and Diane Birch entertained our airwaves. They come round here, then go get their Grammys. Culture on Monocle 24 is your antidote to everyday arts coverage, featuring reports and interviews from everywhere you never knew you wanted to know about, in books, art, music, media, film, and everything from around the world beamed right between your ears. Culture premieres every Monday at 1900 London time, and why not visit monocle.com and iTunes for the archive of over 140 culture shows. Swing by and hear Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24.
The Monocle app has all the details of what's coming up on Monocle 24 and offers you the chance to catch up on the shows you might have missed. You can download programmes to your mobile or tablet to listen offline and set reminders for all your favourites. It also has one-tap access to the latest news reports from our editors and correspondents around the world. The 2525 is Monocle's insider guide to the world's premier resort and business cities. The app features recommendations for the best hotels, restaurants and retail opportunities, along with GPS directions, ensuring Monocle is your one-stop guide to city hopping. You can even give us feedback on personal favourites you've discovered on your travels. The Monocolumn is Instapaper supported and available to read on your mobile, fully integrated to fit any size and screen. The Monocle app is available through iTunes and at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Well, welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And today my guests are Martin Plaut and Samira Shackle. Let's turn now to Nigeria, where Malala Yousafzai, the young woman who famously survived a Taliban assassination attempt, is appealing for the release of the girls who were kidnapped by Boko Haram. Samira, let's start with you. There's been a declared Malala Day by the UN. This is an attempt to kind of highlight the issue of women's education and girls' education. How is that being received around the world, do you think?
I think internationally, Malala has been hugely well received and famous, and she's sort of been a big symbol of something larger than herself. And it's a shame that in Pakistan that's sort of not been the case. I think I was there actually in Pakistan when she was first shot, and there was initially a huge outpouring of public grief. But I think increasingly, as it's been taken up by the West, by the UN, there's been, not everyone, of course, but certainly a sort of movement in public opinion in Pakistan. And to sort of say that, you know, it's a place where conspiracy theories run riot, but people saying things like this was staged so she could get to the West, or she's become, she's an honest victim, but now she's become a tool of the West and she's being used to make Pakistan or the East look bad, etc., etc. And I think that's certainly something that's very painful to her and her family. I think being viewed in that way in their home country, and she's sort of consistently said that where it's safe she'd want to return home. So I think that's a shame, but certainly internationally, I think that she has become a big symbol of hope, of education, of all of those things. She's shown extraordinary resilience.
Martin, she's there in Nigeria, and we'll ask you your opinion of her in a moment. But what's interesting is, at least she's highlighted again the issue of these kidnapped children. That we have a government there in Nigeria which seems to be, completely ignoring the plight of the parents. The story falls out of the headlines. Do you think that she is a good spokeswoman? That she is a useful person to talk about these issues?
Well, look, it's fantastic that she is prepared to go and be used in this way and to raise the issue, and I have nothing but admiration for her. But I was speaking to a colleague in Nigeria yesterday, and he said, there's no pressure really on the government to act. They are not really interested in risking much to go there. I mean, President Jonathan didn't even go to the area because he thought it was too dangerous. He just cancelled a visit. So, I mean, they're not prepared to put their lives on the line. They say that they are worried about the lives of the children concerned, but I don't know whether they really are. And, it worries me that you have someone like Malala. In a sense, the problem is that you have a great lack of legitimacy in the international field. So things like the United Nations and other international organizations latch onto people like that who all of a sudden have a bit of legitimacy, and they suck them dry. And that's why they use, people like film stars and a young girl like her. And I just, worry that, she is a child. She's 17 years old. What are you exposing her to? Day after day, the pressure on her. What kind of life is she going to have?
But do you think that there there's an almost cynical, but using her to be the person who tries to kind of stir up interest in the story again, rather than sending in our diplomats or as you say, getting the kind of Nigerian government involved? Do you think it's kind of bad practice relying, as you say, on a young girl to try and do the dirty work?
Yes, in essence, I think that's absolutely right.
Well, we're going to move on now to South Africa. And Martin, I might pick this up with you first off as well. I wanted to get your opinion on the huge spending cuts have been announced for the South African National Defence Force. Why do you think this is important? Or do you think it is important whether South Africa has a strong military force or not?
I think it's incredibly important. The South African military is one of the few really reliable, solid organizations on the African continent. I mean, the Egyptian military can be pretty strong. The Nigerians, when they get their act together, are. The Ethiopians are as well. But there aren't that many militaries that are really capable of actually putting people into a hostile environment and doing something. The trouble is that at the end of apartheid, a huge amount of money was wasted on absolutely useless military equipment. They bought submarines. Submarines! What on earth were they going to do with those? Or fast fighter jets. I mean, just who were they going to ever take on? The one thing they've never done is replace the ancient heavy lift aircraft, which they require to get their troops around Africa. They are absolutely falling out of the sky. But these are not replaced because there weren't enough bribes, frankly, in it for the people that signed the contracts. And that was the problem. So they got this rubbish, which they spent $5 or $6 billion on, and now they're desperately short of money. And then Africa needs peacekeepers to go in and do the job and hold the ring. I mean, the slogan, African solutions to African problems, is a great one, but you need to have African capability in order to fulfill it.
Samira, that kind of the idea of Africa solving its own problems. We talked at the top of the show about, you know, flying in, you know, the kind of the big man from Washington, and that doesn't seem to work these days. It is interesting that many of the best things that have happened in Africa over the recent years have had African troops involved, that there is a kind of greater sense perhaps of the continent kind of looking at its own problems and trying to resolve those. Do you think that's important?
I think that's very important, yeah. I think particularly when you have such a huge baggage of colony that you should avoid having that. I think if you can avoid having sort of Western troops going in, then you should. I think that certainly from my limited knowledge of that region, that the sort of African Union troops, I think, are generally better received than Western troops. You've got, I think, African Union troops and sort of from various different African countries, peacekeeping forces doing great work in places like Somalia and so on. So I think that it's certainly something good and something that it would be very sad to see collapsing because of poor governance issues within states.
Now, we have one final story which we couldn't resist and you couldn't really make up. A man from Virginia, upon being told that his daughter wanted to be a princess, trekked to the desert of Sudan and planted a homemade flag and declared a kingdom of his own. He's now trying to get Sudan, Egypt and the UN to recognise his state, which he calls the Kingdom of North Sudan. Martin, the first thing about the story that struck me was I didn't realise there was any bits of the land of the continent that were actually kind of unclaimed, as it were.
Well, this is a misnomer. It is not unclaimed. There are two contested boundaries, one in 1902 and one in 1899. And it depends on which boundary you believe as to which. I'm sorry to pop this bubble. But I mean, there's another one just in the south of Sudan called the Alemi Triangle, which is the same sort of area. They're not unclaimed. They're undefined. That is rather a different issue. Both states really claim them, but they haven't resolved it. And frankly, it's just a bit of desert, so what the heck? So he was allowed to go there, and I wish, Jeremiah Heaton, the very best of luck, and I wish his 7-year-old daughter even greater luck in becoming a princess. I think it's a wonderful idea, but honestly, this is just nonsense.
I did say, apparently they made the flag at home, and he said the Egyptians were very nice. I don't think they'll be so nice when they realise he's trying to claim a bit of land that they wouldn't mind having themselves. Samira, ever been tempted to be declare independence for a bit of the world?
Or be a princess?
Yes.
can't say I have. And I also imagine that Sudan and Egypt both have bigger fish to fry at the moment.
I don't think it's going to go down very well. He claims he's going to go back there and make more of it. But there was also a picture. It looked like the lunar landscape as well. I don't think
absolutely
a huge amount of kind of possibilities of him founding his own state there at all, Martin.
But no, absolutely not. But I mean, if he really wants to do some good, there is one thing he really could do, and that is to take back from Egypt a few of those millions of landmines which were laid by the British and the Americans during the Second World War. Do you know that Egypt is the most mined country in the world? and they've been trying to get rid of them for years and years. The Germans, of course, the Italians laid lots of mines as well, and nobody wants to come and get them.
Well, let's see if he can.
There's something.
Yeah, he could tackle that issue in his brief reign as king with his daughter as princess. Well, we're going to have to leave it there. But Martin Plout and Samira Shackle, thank you very much for joining us here.
Pleasure.
On Midori House.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Well, there's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to check in with our correspondent in Belgrade, and we're going to take a tour of art exhibits in Greece, and there's much, much more coming as well. But before any of that, here's James Luckhurst with the latest world news headlines.
Salvage teams say the wrecked Italian cruise ship Costa Concordia has been successfully raised from the undersea platform it's been resting on for the past year. The wreck, the target of one of the biggest maritime salvage operations in history, is now floating about 1 metre above the platform. In all, the reflotation operation is expected to take 6 or 7 days. Ukrainian military officials say a military transport aircraft has been shot down in the east amid fighting with separatist rebels. They say the AN-26 plane was hit at an altitude of 6,500 metres. Palestinian militants have resumed rocket attacks on Tel Aviv after a 24-hour lull in strikes on the Israeli commercial capital. Israel, in turn, has kept up its air and naval bombardments of the Gaza Strip despite growing pressure for a ceasefire. Iraq's parliament has failed to break a political deadlock that's holding up the formation of a new government to tackle an Islamist-led insurgency raging less than 50 miles from Baghdad. After a brief session, parliamentary officials put off until Tuesday efforts to reach agreement between Shiite, Sunni and Kurdish politicians. The chief executive of Qatar Airways, Akbar Al-Bakir, says he's rejected the first three new A380 super jumbos supplied by Airbus. Mr. Al-Bakir added the airline was not yet ready to finalise an order for 50 Boeing 777X aircraft, the US plane maker's new version of its 777 long-haul jet. And the Church of England's governing body has voted in favour of allowing women bishops, overturning centuries of tradition in a church that has been deeply divided on the issue. That's the latest news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. James will be back in another 30 minutes with a full roundup of the world news headlines. But for now, we're going to be checking out with one of our correspondents around the world. Today, well, we normally would go to Belgrade to catch up with Guy Delaunay, but he's actually in Zagreb. Welcome to the show, Guy. And we're going to start actually with events in Slovenia, because there's been an election on Sunday. And could you tell us what the outcome was?
Well, a complete outsider, Andrew, has taken control of the situation. Not yet power, I wouldn't say, but the Miro Cerar party has taken the most votes in Sunday's general election, taking more than a third of the seats in Slovenia's parliament, and that means they will get a chance to form a coalition government. So those coalition talks will already have been getting underway since the results became clear. And the party is named after Miro Cerar himself. This is a little bit, for me, like being back in Cambodia, where you have parties named after the individual politicians concerned. And Miro Cerar is a law professor at Ljubljana University, and he's a newcomer to politics. He only announced that he would form a party and run since the dissolution of parliament, though his mother was, in fact, a former justice minister in Slovenia, so not perhaps entirely new to the whole process.
So how come the country decided to kind of boot out the old guard and elect a kind of unknown?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, he's not really a total unknown, and he was a reasonably well-known figure in Slovenia as an academic. But really, this is all about, it's a story of utter disenchantment with the political class. Now, bearing in mind that the second largest party in these elections is the SDS, and their leader is the former Prime Minister, Janez Janša. Well, Janez Janša is currently serving 2 years in jail for corruption, so that isn't exactly somebody you'd want to put your faith in. And the last government was led by a movement known as Positive Slovenia. They fell apart in May after infighting which led to Prime Minister Alena Bratusek resigning. This is very much similar to the sort of situation we saw in Australia, say, where you had somebody who was doing a reasonable job as Prime Minister, forces within her own party turned against her, and she was forced to dissolve Parliament. So they weren't going to vote for Positive Slovenia. In fact, Positive Slovenia didn't get a single seat. And all of this has taken place against the backdrop of perpetual economic crisis, which very nearly led to an EU bailout of Slovenia, which I think a lot of people were dreading. Didn't happen in the end, in part due to the fairly reasonable measures taken by Alena Bratusek, but she didn't survive as Prime Minister, and there we are.
It is a weird turnaround. Just a few years ago, when we first started Monocle, I remember sending reporters to Slovenia because it was being touted as like the new Austria. It was like it seemed to have good governance. It was its economy was doing well. It joined the euro. It was quickly into the EU. It seemed to have modern institutions. Was that a bit of a facade? And actually, underneath it was still a bit of a kind of creaky member of the former Yugoslavia.
There was certainly a lot of that. A lot of the financial institutions were still in state hands. There was a lack of transparency in the way in which those institutions were run. The thing is, though, if you go to Ljubljana today, and I was there most recently, just a matter of weeks ago, you'll find a very charming city. It doesn't really feel like a capital. It's like the rest of the capitals of the new countries which have emerged from the former Yugoslavia. It doesn't feel like a capital city at all. It has the feeling of a large provincial city, and it seems very well to do, and people there seem to be thriving. But all of this sort of hangover from the former Yugoslavia days, the lack of a real sort of democratic roots and transparency in all strata of society, finally came home to roost with the European economic crisis. And the wheels came off a little bit. I think people got a little bit overexcited, perhaps, because of what had happened in Greece and Cyprus, that Slovenia might be the next candidate for a meltdown. It was never going to be that severe, but they've learned some lessons, and the electorate certainly have, which is why you're seeing this rejection of the established political elite.
Now, back in your normal stomping ground, back in Serbia, they're not very good at holding on to their finance ministers, it seems.
No, they're pretty rotten at it, and the latest one to go is Lazar Krstic, and he quit over the weekend. Now, he was a very interesting figure, Lazar Krstic. When you met him, you'd think, how old is this guy exactly? I mean, although he had a very good, healthy and thick beard, you would look at him and think, this guy surely isn't long out of graduate school. And that was indeed the case. He was 29 when he was appointed as Serbia's finance minister. He was a Yale graduate, considered to be a big star. He worked for the McKinsey consultancy outfit. And he was brought into Serbia to basically get it in shape for joining the European Union. He was the guy who was going to prescribe very tough economic medicine to deal with Serbia's own economic and financial hangovers from being in the former Yugoslavia. He has, over the weekend, decided that he is not able to carry out those duties.
And he's not able because he hasn't got the backing or he hasn't got the skills?
Well, he pretty much said verbatim that Prime Minister Aleksandar Vučić was too soft-hearted to implement these reforms which he'd set out, that you needed to slash public sector jobs and wages, sell off or close state-owned industries. Basically, this was the prescription. But the patient in the form of Aleksandar Vučić said, well, the rest of the body isn't going to be able to stand up to this. In other words, if he enacted all of these measures, he might lose the goodwill of Serbia's people rather too quickly to put any reforms into place. So Lazar Krstic has pretty much said, well, we both want the same thing in a way, but we've got different ideas of how we want to carry it out.
Well, Guy, great as ever to speak to you. That's Guy Delaunay, who's normally in Belgrade, but today is in Zagreb. Up next, we're going to look at the future of the art film.
Monocle 24 is your 24-hour-a-day international radio service. Based in the heart of London, with contributions from our bureau in Hong Kong, Tokyo, New York, Toronto and Zurich, and reporters in more than 30 countries, we broadcast a mix of news, discussion, features, reportage, reviews, music and more. From retail to travel, food to urbanism, business to film, Monocle 24 has it covered.
One of the things that I would like to allude to, which is very much the kind of thing that you're doing here, is you're having this kind of discussion. But the discussion that needs to take place, where the forward thinking needs to come from, is from the brains trusts and the think tanks, and they're not doing it.
To call it an international conference, that's difficult in itself. The really difficult thing is then to start to implement the conclusions.
I was actually the last correspondent to send dispatches by carrier pigeon. It's not something I'm proud of.
There are two kinds of games. The games that uses the city, and the other kind is the city that uses the games.
Plus, our carefully curated playlist is the soundtrack to your day, stretching from Stockholm to Sydney, Brooklyn to Bogota.
It was like entering the gates of heaven.
You can hear us live at monocle.com, catch up with anything you may have missed on our Time Shift player, download our bespoke app for your smartphone, and hear it all on iTunes.
I like the sense that you just have no idea where it's going to go.
Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
Well, welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. 15 institutions from around the world have joined forces to showcase a very global lineup of artists' films. In London, it's the Whitechapel Gallery in the east of the city that's staging the screenings. A bit earlier, I caught up with Omar Khalif, who is the curator at the Whitechapel, and asked him about the show, his role, and what makes a film art. But I began by asking him why it's important for galleries to stage films.
I think it's important that a gallery thinks about how artists are working with moving images, because over the last 10 years or so, since really technology started to enable artists everywhere in the world to make films and to produce work independently, it's become one of the dominant trends in visual culture and visual art more generally. It's something that I think has often been sidelined or kind of removed from the museum context because of the traditional view or notion that a museum is there to show painting and sculpture. And so at the Whitechapel, one of the things that we are dedicated to doing is showcasing artists' film and artists' work from around the world. And this particular program, Artist Film International, is about working together with different people to get a full global sense of what artists are doing with the moving image everywhere.
Are they being, you know, projected against walls? What's the format and kind of what length are the films?
It's kind of interesting. At the Whitechapel, we show them in the auditorium all day on a loop, and they vary in length. From some films are 3 minutes, such as one of the films we have today from Vietnam that we're showing in the season. But other institutions, some of our partners, take these films and they stage them into exhibitions with walls and galleries and create immersive environments for their experience.
Now, you're a curator with, I'm sure, strong opinions. 15 organisations here choosing the films. How complicated was that for you all to agree on a shortlist?
Well, it can be very complicated, but actually we try and be very democratic. So we have this idea of mutual trust. So all of the institutions in the mix, all 15 of them, we all somehow ideologically agree that we all have good taste. And so the idea and the framework or the agreement between the partners is that any individual in the group We set an annual theme and everyone nominates a particular film, and our implicit agreement is that we will show that film automatically in our venue, and we will use that the kind of trust of that person. So the idea that local knowledge comes first. So we have partners in Afghanistan, in Vietnam, in Norway, and we trust them. So we show what it is that they send us. And sometimes it can be really surprising what we get to see.
You've only been a curator since the beginning of the year at the Whitechapel, and anybody who looks at your CV will see that you've done lots of really interesting work with Africa, with the Middle East. Was it important for you to have that reflected in the line of films? You mentioned Afghanistan there, for example, and we often don't think of there being art institutions that can function very easily in Afghanistan. But are those the kinds of links that you're trying to make with the Whitechapel and with these other institutions?
Absolutely. I think, you know, the idea that art can exist in isolation from everything else, to me, is you know, it's just hilarious to think that we live in our own microcosm. And I think we have to look at other cultures. And one of the great things about this program and other programs and what I'm interested in doing is thinking about how actually individuals in different countries speak with a similar formal language and they are interested in similar concerns, but also there are nuances and specificities that we don't necessarily see. And I think that the space of art is an interesting one because it's discursive and it's experimental, and so it's liberated from the very didactic kind of politics that you'd see on the news. So, for example, the artist whose work here, Masuda Noura, who shows work from Afghanistan, it's a beautiful film, actually, where it's a series of four women in this desolate landscape trying to push forward this derelict car. And in a way, you could see the car as an allegory for the state of life in Afghanistan for women, or the state of life more generally, and that there is this banding together of a community of sorts trying to make something happen collectively. And those ideas and those themes resonate globally. If you think of the era that we live in, it's an era of constant struggle and global uprising. And I think it's really great to be able to look at it through artists' eyes as well.
And what makes the films artist films? Because when I look at the descriptions, you know, some of them, for example, sound almost like documentary in their makeup, and other pieces playful. And, you know, for example, there's one film which uses scooters in a dance piece, almost in choreography. So what makes a film an artist film, do you think?
That's a very complicated question that has been subject
to much
debate since, you know, Steve McQueen's rise and his Oscar fame. You know, is this an artist film by Steve McQueen, or is it a feature film? And it's a question that I always return to. And I think if a work is made by an artist and the intention is that it circulates within the art world in some way, then it is an artist's work. And I think that we are in a moment, particularly because technology has enabled us to work across forms more than ever, and to actually, someone in Afghanistan can use the internet to look at different kinds of practice, whether it be dance or moving image. There's been an erosion of genre in a sense. So, you know, documentary and artist film and installation and performance all start to meld together in a very interesting and exciting way. I think these works are all classified as artist films because they actually benefit from the context of the art institution and that kind of liberating space whereby they're not read literally. They are read as pieces that have a kind of aesthetic or conceptual language to them. So the piece you mentioned about the scooter piece, I think, is very interesting because it looks like just a piece of public pageantry. These men on scooters wearing these masks to this operatic score, and what it's really about is a critique of the fact that Ho Chi Minh City has become industrialized incredibly quickly, and that the natural green landscape and public space has started to disappear from view. And so this scooter dance is kind of a celebration of the landscape of Vietnam, but also a comment on the fact that it's become so polluted and that these performers have to wear these face masks to help them stop them from being polluted and being able to breathe and live and survive. So it's I think that there's a criticality ultimately that underpins these works, which I think also is really important.
And are we allowed to know which film was your nominee for the list?
My film that's nominated for the list isn't on this particular one because it's a program we roll out throughout the year, and my nominee screened earlier in the year. If I was going to pick two favourites, it would be Udam Tran Nugan's film The Waltz of the Equestrians, the one that you mentioned, The Machine Equestrians, because I think there's a beautiful pageantry about it, but at the same time it's also very critical and playful and also raises a whole load of concerns. And also I really like Amir Yatsev's piece Detroit. When you first see the title you think, oh, this is a documentary about Detroit, but actually it's this conceptual piece about an area in Palestine where Israeli troops train, and it was just happens to be called Detroit, and it's a simulation of a place. And I think we live in a world where sight is consistently simulated because of the internet, and we create and imagine our different contexts. We're transported to different places constantly through the moving image, through the internet. And in a way, this program is about transporting the British audience onto a journey of artist film from all over. And I think that's, for me,
a piece obviously that cuts across the day's news agenda, and it makes these films have a kind of a different resonance. And just finally, I mean, it's interesting talking to you as a curator. I think most people would imagine, many people would imagine the curator's role is still kind of looking at paintings and saying, yes, put this one up on this corner. But your role is, is trying to use contemporary media and use the digital world and use film and use the fact that so many people have access to those tools to make art now. What is the job of the curator these days?
The job of the curator really, I think, is to be able to create new meaning through looking at work. And the way that I engage with things is that I'm constantly looking at work across the visual arts sector, across forms, across histories, modern and contemporary, and also across cinema and dance and performance, and thinking about the context of what we show at the gallery and how, as a curator, we can find ways to create new meanings around the work and also ways to engage new audiences in it. So really, you can see it as partly an authorship role, partly an editorial role, but partly about taking things that may be marginalized or may be hidden and bring them back into the world or into the world for the first time. And it's an incredibly exciting and challenging job because you work with people from all over the world and constantly have to negotiate all sorts of issues. Afghanistan being one, the complexity of getting material to the site can be very difficult, but it's those conversations with those partners that becomes incredibly exciting. I see the role of the curator as being one that tries to locate the institution in a global context. And so also we show a lot of this work online on our website, and it's also about sharing it with a broader public than simply those who walk into the building.
The films are on now at the Whitechapel and many other institutions indeed, but let's start with the Whitechapel here in London. People can go to the website and they can see what's showing, and it's called Artists Film International. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. And if you hadn't had enough culture already, we've got more for you, because this is the point in the show where we review one of the cultural happenings around the world. And today we're talking art, and we're talking art in Greece, and we're talking art in Greece with Kimberly Bradley, who joins us on the line now from the island of Paros. And I believe you have kind of like your feet in the water. Tell us where you are.
I'm in an olive grove on the island of Paros on a beach called Agia Irini, which means Saint Irene.
Tough.
At the moment, yeah, it's not too bad.
tell us why you're there.
I'm actually on holiday.
No, I mean the art.
There is on the facing island, Antiparos, which actually used to be a part of Paros, an exhibition by American artist Joe Bradley. And he's represented by a Swiss gallerist called Eva Prisenhuber, who's long owned a plot of land on Antiparos. And this year, she decided to kind of overtake a small space that used to be a bakery in the very central part of the old village and do a little show.
Now, let's just rewind a little bit, because I know at this time of year, there's always a very famous event that takes place on Idra, and that's backed by a big collector. Is this all part and parcel of the same thing, or is this just lots of different islands now beginning to get in on the art game?
It's actually the second scenario that you're describing. Iwano on the island of Idra since 2008 has overtaken a little slaughterhouse as a project space. And he, just to also backtrack a bit, is one of the major, major art collectors in the world. And in the 80s, he started the Desta Foundation. He's got a massive collection and often shows, curated shows at the Desta Foundation in Athens. But he overtook the slaughterhouse a few years ago to allow one artist per year to do a solo show, and they can do whatever they want. He gives them carte blanche. And I was actually there 2 weeks ago, and this year he gave it to Pavel Altar, who did a very kind of interesting spiritual show that deals a little bit with an old artifact from Crete. But anyway, the show ends up being a little bit indecipherable, but it's very interactive. So you go into the slaughterhouse, you see him working with his son, you see his very typical little dolls and other things like that. And it's up until the end of September.
Well, I know that that's one of the most glamorous tickets in the art world. And so congratulations on securing yourself one of those. But what's interesting is now then, what you're talking about is, that Antiparos has a show. And I understand that the island of Samos also has another show going on. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
That's another thing entirely. There's a new space. It's about 3 years old, called Art Space Pythagorion. And it's named that because Pythagoras lived in this little town on the island of Samos. And it's the side of the island that faces Turkey. In fact, there's just a channel of about 1 or 2 kilometers. And you can see Turkey from this art space. And there's a German-Greek couple that has had a long history of visiting Samos. And 3 years ago, they decided to take a derelict mid-century hotel, renovate it, create this exhibition space, and always curate artists in who have something to do with boundaries. So the first year was Harun Faraki. Last year, which I did visit, it was Slavs and Tartars, which is an artist collective that deals with the Middle East and Central Asia. And this year, it will be a Turkish artist from Berlin named Nevin Aladag, and that opens in about 3 weeks.
Now, obviously not all of these artists are Greek, but what's interesting, I guess, as an outsider is, we've watched what's happened in Greece over the last few years, and we have a sense of, of all the problems, but it sounds like the art world is responding with a certain vigour, and there's quite exciting things going on. Is that the sense you get as you travel around these destinations, or is it rather different that perhaps these places are popping up because they know that there's foreign tourists coming in from around the world with cash to spend and might be investors in the art world?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, Ioana's project is a bit older and I think it's tradition. But what I'm seeing with the public space on Antiparos and also Art Space Pythagorio, the economy is indeed turning around. And I think that some of these, they all have different reasons for setting their spaces up, of course. But I think they're kind of looking at, what is in Greece besides Athens in terms of art? How can we get people to come to a destination, not just to hang out on the beach, but also look at something cultural? In the space of, for example, Art Space Pythagorio, how do you get people thinking about the location? That's why often curating these people or the artists who deal with this boundary issue, because that island really does overlook everything. I'm very intrigued. I'm hearing some rumors that there will be more next year, to be honest. And we'll see, where the Greek art scene goes and where the island art scene goes.
And tell me, are they getting a good showing of people coming to the islands to see the art?
I think so. What I heard, Hydra, of course, I was at the opening, and that's a very exclusive event. But Hydra is a very popular island for both Greeks and travelers. And it's only about an hour by hydrofoil. So I know the Destin Foundation Project Space gets a good amount of visitors, also because the show is about 4 months long. It's up for a while. And it's very, very close to the port. So you can just take a little five-minute walk and take a look at it. The Antiparos show, hard to say, but I heard that 200 people were at the opening, which was just about 10 days ago. And Antiparos is really increasing in popularity just as a destination. It's sleepy because there's no direct port, no big boats go there, yet at the same time there are a lot of investors buying land, there's an outdoor cinema that's very popular, and it's where a lot of the media and film people from Athens go, so I have a feeling that's going to see a lot of visitors as well. Now, Art Space Pythagorion is interesting. Samos, yes, has lots of visitors, but what I love about that space I saw last year, the locals really use it, the kids go into the space in the evenings. It's open from 7 p.m. until 1 a.m. Interesting exhibition hours, and it's become a bit of a town center. It's fantastic.
Well, Kimberly, I'm glad you're having a tough time there reporting on the art world in Greece for us. That was, of course, Kimberly Bradley, who's normally kind of sitting in Berlin, but is currently doing the art world in Greece. And if you want to know more about Greece and all about the Med, look out for Monocle Mediterraneo, which is going to be on newsstands very soon.
But that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our very special guests Samira Shackle and Martin Plaut, who joined me at the top of the show to discuss the stories of the day. And also this show, well, it was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, so we'll give him thanks. And also thank Gaia Lutz, our researcher, and Johan Laux. Our studio manager is Joel Church. Next is the headlines, and then after that is going to be Robert Bound with The Culture Show, and that's worth sticking around for. Then at 2200 hours, it's time to hear The Monocle Daily. And this show, of course, will be back at the same time tomorrow, which is 1800 hours London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's just time for me to say goodbye, and thank you very much for listening.
London. Tao Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.